McDermott Lecturer for this year, Mr. Mark Helprin. We're especially pleased to have a man of his stature visit us because I believe he possesses a combination of abilities that may serve as a paradigm for our own students to emulate. Someone who, in his own life, manifests the complex and necessary interpenetration of knowledge and virtue. I should perhaps say in his two lives, for he is both an author of novels and short stories that are deeply profound and extraordinarily beautiful explorations of the human condition. And he is an acutely perceptive and persuasive commentator on many of the critical political issues of our times. When our original PhD program was founded here some 40 years ago by Louise Cowan and Wilma McKendall, it offered one PhD, but an interdisciplinary one, a joint degree in politics and literature. That was its official name. The program was based on the somewhat counterintuitive notion, at least it seems so now, that politics and literature reinforce each other. But I believe they do. The premise this notion is based on is that poets make citizens. Good poets make noble citizens, as Homer made the Greeks, Dante the Italians, and Shakespeare the English-speaking peoples. I'm glad to say the original PhD program here remains vigorous at the foundation of our present one. And if we were to look for someone who in his own career represents why the combination of politics and literature has such power, we would need to look no further than Mr. Helprin. And let me say also to the man sitting to his left, Dr. John Alvis of our PhD program in politics and literature, and earlier recipient of that, who also combines in his work, his scholarly work and interest in politics and literature. I thought it might be appropriate if I asked John to say a few words before Mr. Helprin talks.
Well, it seems to me especially fitting that Mark Helprin should speak at the University of Dallas, because I take it that we have a common aim. The purpose statement of the University of Dallas says that the goal of higher education should be the cultivation of the intellectual and moral virtues. And I think those virtues could be concisely put as self-knowledge and self-government. Self-knowledge, the intellectual, self-government, the moral. And it appears to me that when you look to the work of Mark Helprin, his fiction and then his commentaries on social affairs, you see that they are dedicated to those two aims. Self-knowledge in the oldest sense of the word, as knowing what you are in the light of the standard of what you ought to be. And self-government is the condition you attain on the basis of that self-knowledge, so that you are a free human being who can govern yourself and therefore need less help from the machinery of government to promote a decent life. And so, it seems to me especially fitting that he should address us, if indeed I'm right in thinking that that's the aim of his work, and I would ask you to join me in welcoming him.
Thank you both. It's very hard to live up to such a description, really, it is. I'd like to just add a note about knowledge of self, which has come from my experience in publishing as it has evolved in the last few decades. And that is that frequently, or if you notice that publishing has dissolved into a sort of a bifurcated set of targeting. On the one hand, there's the John, I won't name any names, I call him John Geisha. And his books are to airports what kudzu is to the banks of the Tallahassee. There's that type of writing which is has been put into a computer and discovered to be written at a third grade level. I mean, it's not an insult, it all it is, but it's also just simply the literal truth that it was done. They have things that they use to rank school books in terms of the structure of sentences, vocabulary, repetition, and his books came out as third grade. But then on the other half, there's a very complicated set of targeting, which is targeted to people's individual, to ethnicity, to sex, to political philosophy, to sexuality, et cetera, and the books are essentially a form of flattery, and everyone is supposed to read books. You know, if you are a Hispanic sturgeon fisherman, there's a set of books for you. If you are a Jewish astronaut, there's a set of books for you, et cetera, down the line. And not only do publishers ask, what is your platform, but they also ask, you know, what are you aiming at? This comes from the fact that in the way literature has been taught in colleges and high schools and just in general criticism, it's common belief that it should be a mirror. And if you said self-knowledge, then that's what you said is mistaken for gazing into the mirror. And what I say to publishers and other people when they tell me that is, I say, usually quite obstreperous, which is costly, but it's fun. I say, and I often do, no. By the way, that's the most powerful word in the English language. Someone says something, they say, well, and you say, no. That really puts you on record. And I say, it's not a mirror, and it shouldn't be a mirror. It should be a window, you see? A window. And that's why I can read a book about a black woman, and it doesn't matter that I'm not a black woman, or she can read a book by me, and it doesn't matter that she's not a white man. And that's just the way it is. Unfortunately, people have forgotten that. Now, returning to the subject, as things tend to degrade as they get older, and this we know, gentlemen, so do I. And we're getting more and more relaxed. The first presentation that I gave here, although somewhat skew and off-kilter, was nonetheless the most theoretical. Then last night it was less theoretical and more practical. And today it's going to be even more practical, although there is a bend to time and it will sort of veer a little bit toward the theoretical. But it's less formal. It's going to be less formal. And I did expect a class. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start off with a quiz. Now, when I'm in an audience, my heart starts to pound when I know that there's an opportunity to participate, because what I want to do really is to come up here and say to the speaker, excuse me, push him off, and I'm thinking of things to say, it backs up and my blood pressure rises and I get very nervous. So when whoever's speaking, the lecturer will ask a question, I very much want to answer it. On the other hand, I get kind of nervous that I might give the wrong answer, which would be a terrible shame. Now, the purpose of these questions that I'm going to ask you as we go through this, and we're going to be touching on various topics that relate to the question how to fight a war and how not to fight a war, which is centered on this war that we're fighting now. The purpose of the questions is actually to get wrong answers, because in doing so, I can then illustrate a common conception among intelligent, educated people who simply may not have looked at something in this particular way. So don't be ashamed to give a wrong answer. And by the way, just as an example, in the first class that I ever taught at Harvard, where I taught for a while, it was 1972, and I had a class of freshmen, and I asked them, because it was a time when the Vietnam War was beginning to close out, but there was plenty going on, and there was a lot of ferment on that campus and many others. And I said, to put things in perspective, I said, what are the casualties? Tell me what you think the number of casualties were in World War II and in Vietnam. And then I filled it in for them. I said, World War II lasted from 1939 through August of 1945, so it was 6 years. And the Vietnam War has thus far gone on 10 years. What are the casualties? So they said, these were Harvard freshmen, supposedly, when I was a just gotten into Harvard. They give you, by the way, they give you a diploma when you get in. Did you know that? It's a certificate, it's a real diploma, and it says Harvard University, whatever. It's your certificate, a diploma of acceptance. and they then I was brought down to the Harvard Club in New York, which is the most magnificent place, and just unbelievably magnificent. And as a kid, I was 12, and they got the beginning freshman class who were from that area, and the dean who welcomed us said to us, "You are the finest young men of your generation." Immediately, I knew there was something wrong. How could he know that? What a presumption. But anyway, these were Harvard freshmen who thought they were the finest young men, and by that time women, of their generation. And they had no idea. Of course, in World War II, it was more than 50 million in debt. In the Vietnam War, about 2 million in debt over 10 years. So I mean, it's infinitely worse. And they had absolutely no idea. So don't worry about being off. First quiz, and this is a... in these questions that I'm going to ask you, there's going to be a trick question, but you won't know which one it is. I'm going to describe a military force, and I would like you to tell me to whom it belongs. It's very important, really. It's a good way to approach the subject. And when I describe it, I'll tell you also what the United States has, so you can make a comparison. I'm dealing only with active forces now, not reserve, because that gets very complicated and rather arcane. In the Army, this active force, there are 253,000 soldiers in its army. In the United States Army, as of, these are 2007 figures, 522,000. It has 25,000 Marines, whereas the United States has 175,000. It has 248,000 sailors, whereas the United States has 336,000. It has 6,000 main battle tanks, whereas the United States has 8,000 main battle tanks. It has 2,500 combat aircraft, whereas the United States has 4,500 combat aircraft. It has 4 aircraft carriers, whereas the United States has 11. It has 142 principal surface combatants, destroyers, cruisers, that kind of thing, whereas the United States has 95. It has 39 attack submarines, whereas the United States has 57. And it has 73 minor surface combatants, meaning things like PT boats, patrol boats, riverine craft, etc. The United States has 27, it has 73. It has 28 amphibious ships. These are LPDs, LPHs, the big docking ships from which you make land invasions with the Marines, etc. And the United States has 32. It has 429 sea lift ships to take expeditionary forces across the oceans, whereas the United States has 219. And it has 76 aerial tankers for aerial refueling, whereas the United States has 656. Who am I talking about? About whom am I speaking?
Israel.
Who?
Israel.
No. No.
China.
China, no.
Russia.
France, no. Now, you just named some in going China and Russia. Well, Russia is about the second military power to the United States. China is up there and getting up there. Israel's a very powerful nation, certainly for its size, extremely potent, has to be. You've named very strong countries. France is one of the great military powers, along with Britain, and of course, you just bumped down the scale. You've named very powerful countries, China, Russia, Israel. You know what this force is? This is the ghost force. Do you know what I mean when I say the ghost force? Who can figure that out? This is the force that the United States threw away between 1986 and 2007. When in 1986 we had a war, in 2007 we were fighting a war, and in between that time, over Republican and Democratic administrations, we threw away that force. That's what we got rid of in that time. A very large force. It's enough to have been the second strongest country militarily in the world, and we chopped it away and got rid of it. Now, the reason that that's relevant to what we're talking about today is that, as you know, part of the problem in the war on terrorism and part of the problem in the war in Iraq and Afghanistan is that we are terribly overstretched and we have shortages. Why do we have shortages? Well, one reason we have shortages is because we threw half of our stuff away. in some cases more than half, but the degradation is synergistic. There's a wonderful example I can explain to you. Take, for example, let's just imagine a Coast Guard unit which has three C-130s, those are kind of fat, pigeon-like planes, the workhorses of airlift, and also maritime patrol, et cetera. It's got three C-130s, and it's in the hangar someplace in South Carolina, and they have to patrol a certain amount of ocean. Now, they're not going to get new ones because of these cuts. Some were thrown away. In fact, one of them goes because we've cut so much. So in the late 80s, the 90s particularly, and even during the last 8 years, at least one of those is finished. So there are two left. So they've got to then patrol roughly the same area. You can't just leave out an area, or they patrol less time, but they go out less, but they can't because they leave gaps. So they're going to be working at least one plane's worth harder. What happens when they work harder is, of course, that there's more strain put on them, and they wear out sooner. So there has to be more maintenance. And the maintenance is performed by a staff which has been reduced. So the people who are doing the maintenance are working much harder, and therefore they're working less effectively. The more experienced among them, who are older, tend to quit because they don't want to work very hard for the same amount of money and frustrating things. So you have people who are less experienced working longer hours on planes that are more strained. They also don't have the proper spare parts because the spare parts budget has been reduced. So what happens is they tend, eventually, very soon, they will begin to cannibalize one of the planes to put the parts in the other plane, the plane that's less worn. So now they've got one plane to do the work, and it's working three times as hard. And there's three times as much strain, and they lose their other qualified people. And eventually it's a downward spiral so that a one-third cut becomes equal to much more than a one-third cut. If you just measure the cuts that I mentioned by numerically as a percentage, it doesn't reflect the true situation. The true situation is it goes much deeper than that. Now, when we went into Iraq, we had planned to have 100,000 troops staying there for stability operations after we left. And if you think about that, what you have to think is, what was their job? First of all, they had a 9,000 mile supply line. They were 9,000 miles distant from the United States. This is a multiplier effect, which I'll get to in a second. But they were in a country that had a population at that time of roughly 24 to 26 million and was 170,000 square miles. That works out to one soldier per 240 people and per 1.7 square miles. Now, for many years, Israel has occupied the West Bank and used to occupy Gaza. Israel has, let's take the West Bank as an example for this, because they're no longer in Gaza. Israel has approximately 30,000 soldiers in a comparable deployment in the West Bank, which has a population of 1.2 million and is 2,300 square miles. That works out to one soldier per 40 people and one soldier per 1/13 of a square mile. So that the ratios of Israeli soldiers to population and area compared to U.S. soldiers in Iraq compared to population and area are, six times more concentration of Israeli soldiers in the West Bank than there are U.S. soldiers in Iraq to population, and 12 times in terms of area, which is a tremendous difference. The West Bank is completely surrounded by Israeli armed forces. There's no open borders with anybody. Jordan is pretty much sealed off, and the rest is actually Israel. And there's a short river barrier in the River Jordan because it sort of goes like this, the West Bank goes like that. And the Jordan River is a pretty short defensive barrier. So it's easy to defend. It's been occupied for 40 years now, and more than 40 years. And the Israelis have a population that knows the language fluently. I mean, half of Israel comes from Arab countries, and they speak Arabic and know the culture and the language, and they have cooperation with the population, which they know. It's culturally familiar to them. And yet, if you look at the history of Israel and the West Bank, and you think about, well, what control does Israel have over the West Bank, what is the security situation there, etc., they have much more favorable conditions than we had, we could possibly ever have had in Iraq. And yet, they've been living through a nightmare, which they very much would like to disentangle themselves from. Well, half of them would, half of them wouldn't. This was what we faced. Now, if you look at it another way, we had the same ratio of troops to population in Iraq as there are policemen in New York City to the citizens of New York, which is quite extraordinary because the police in New York are not at the end of the 9,000-mile supply chain. They, in fact, live off the land at Starbucks and Whole Foods, and mainly donuts. They don't have to guard their enclaves. You know, they don't have to have patrols around the police stations and everything like that. They don't come, the police stations are not shelled except in the Bronx. And they actually depend, obviously, upon the existing civil order because the population is not, does not go around armed with RPGs and penetrators and machine guns attacking them all the time. And in addition, the police in New York don't have to build schools, guard pipelines, build refurbished power plants, and reconstruct the government. So you can imagine the task that we assign our soldiers to. What it comes down to is that, assuming that you that the goal can be achieved, even if you assume that, which I don't, and I'll get to that later perhaps, or I got to it last night, I don't know. Even if you assume that the goal is feasible, then we simply try to do it with a lesser force than was required, lesser tools. And for anybody who's ever built a house or done repairs or anything, then you know that the great problem of doing any kind of material work is you've got to have the right tool. If you have the wrong tool, you will spend hours and hours and hours and do a lousy job and probably cut yourself and scrape yourself and ruin what you're doing. With the right tool, you must make your tools conform to the task. We had the tools, we threw them away, we decided not to use them. That brings up the question of how you pay for a war. So we're going to have a micro seminar on defense economics here. And I guarantee you, I spent a long time at the Kennedy School at Harvard and at many other places studying defense economics and all that kind of stuff. I've never heard this approach. I happen to think it's a very good approach, and I can communicate it in 8 minutes to you with your help, because now we're going to use this thing that I detest called crowd knowledge. You know, it's the new thing, but the internet is that if you have lots of people, you can get a superior result. Well, you can't, except that one thing it's really good for is making lists, because things occur to people that wouldn't otherwise agree. You can't approach a real question this way, but you can make lists. So I'd like you to help me by telling me how you pay for a war. What are the different ways in which to pay for a war? In America, we, and that includes the highest officials, really the highest officials, don't think of how you pay. We have a war. We don't really think about it clearly. How do you pay for a war? Let's hear some ways.
Taxes.
That's excellent. And that includes surtaxes, excise taxes, and many other millions of types of taxes that that legislators can think of. Taxes. What else?
Borrow.
What?
You borrow.
Borrowing. Exactly. That's war bonds, Charlie Chaplin, and Uncle Sam, and the Chip.
Steal wealth from conquering territories.
Steal wealth from pillaging. I didn't even think of that. Probably zero.
Reallocate spending.
What?
Reallocate spending.
Reallocation. On my list, I have reallocation of government spending from various or all categories to defense. Other? Hey, I've got 10 here.
We get help from all of the other nations that are
right
by the line. You're kidding me.
spreading the costs among allies with contributions in cash or kind or assumption of responsibilities. Okay? Otherwise?
Private donations from citizens.
What was that? Donations from citizens?
Private donations, yeah.
Private donations?
Like Bill Gates giving,
Yeah, well, of course, people love to do that. Well, okay, I think that under my category, I would have, where do I have that? Oh, yes, legislated, coerced, or voluntary, well, it's different. Okay, private donations, but that really is not a common way. I mean, I don't think that's, it happens. People then, they melt their jewelry and stuff like that. So we'll call that minus zero, private donations. Yep.
Well, that's what I was going to say. In World War II, for example, people collected
scrap. Right. Okay. So that's good. Private donations. Waiting back.
Inflation.
Excellent. But, and I call that printing money.
Yes.
Any others? Yeah.
Well, commanding in the form of a draft. It's cheaper.
Right. I have that under legislated, coerced, I don't have that, but okay, that's good. Draft. That's minus double zero. Draft. Okay, and what?
Have the invaded country pay for it.
Okay, that's similar to stealing the wealth of the countries that you're invading. Okay, and what?
Sell off assets.
Sell off assets. Yes. Selling assets. Okay, selling assets. Okay, now for the interest of time, I'll read you some more that I thought. There are other ones. Some of them are very obvious. Using accumulated surplus monies or material that you have saved up over the years to put in your kitty for a rainy day. That's, in fact, we do that in terms of material. There are stockpiles all around the country, which were made during the Cold War, which have things like titanium and even oil and gasoline, strategic stockpiles. In other words, your savings, your strategical savings. That's another one. Legislated, coerced, or voluntary suppression of civilian demand to lower prices and shift resources to defense. And that's part of the scrap drive type of answer, but it also includes monetary tools. Then there's drawing down military reserves without replacement and shorting procurement and reallocating forces so as to thin or abandon certain previously covered sectors and tasks. That's a price that you pay, you see, because it increases the risk and it also you pay the price if you lose in that area or your position erodes. And then there's fighting with insufficient resources and thus paying away by elongating the time and increasing casualties and overall risks. That's a way to pay for a war. And then finally, losing. That's the ultimate price. And you can really do that if you don't make adequate preparations. Now, what avenues did we have before we got into this war and at the end of the Cold War? Obviously, we could have kept up our defense spending. That would have been foolish because when Russia collapsed, we didn't need to. But in my view, we reduced it way, way too much while expanding the reach of NATO. I mean, we enlarged NATO and made it cover areas that where there was certain to be conflict. And at the same time, particularly the Europeans, and also we gutted it in terms of its capacity. So that was speaking more loudly and carrying a smaller stick. And that, of course, would lead to trouble. I mean, it makes sense. You extend your reach and you weaken your capacity to do anything, which is just the opposite of what you should do. But we had a particular, financially, in terms of defense economics, you should know the following. Our 2004 defense budget, and I'm using 2004 because that was when we were just sort of in the middle of things, and it was 3 years after 2001, and we had been in Iraq, and the security situation really began to get very bad. What was the defense budget in terms of percentage of GDP? Does anyone have any idea? Roughly, as a guess?
3.4.
Good guess. 3.89 percentage of GDP. I'll just go through these figures, except maybe one of them, I think. In the average yearly defense expenditures, percentage of GDP from 1940 to 2000 in all years was 8.5%. And that's war, peace, mobilization, non-mobilization, demobilization, etc. Twice as much. In war and mobilization years, which of course 2004 was, the average was 13.3%. They're spending a third in terms of GDP. In Republican administrations throughout that period, 1940 to 2000, Republicans spent 7.3% of GDP on average for defense. And this is what you're talking about from 1940 to 2000, many different presidencies, many different eras in American history, but that was the average. Democrats spent 9.4%, of course, because of World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. They even higher. Clinton, who you know, Clinton's famous for the, I believe it was Chelsea Clinton, who was approached by a general at the White House. The general sat next to him and began to talk to her, and she said, "We don't talk to the military." Okay? That was their view, and it really was their view. But even Clinton, when there was no war, and he's a Democrat who's anti-military, spent 3.6% of GDP. Under Bush in 2004, we're spending 3.89%, which is a fraction more, in the midst of fighting a war, which was very demanding, where we didn't have enough troops. Now, what can we have done, theoretically? Well, in World War II, in the peak year of 1945, we spent 40% of our GDP on defense. 40%. And that was when, at a time when the margin, and this when, I can't get into that because it's a whole separate topic, but what's important here is what we call the marginal availability of costs. In that, imagine at the time of the Depression, if you think back to what we had, everybody had so much less. I mean, so much less. Even rich people then, I mean, not the very, very wealthy, but what the sort of normal run-of-the-mill rich person lived like a lower middle class person today. Simply had less, and there was less of everything. So therefore, what you took from each individual family was proportionately much more, made it more difficult to survive. And in World War II, we managed to take 40% of our GDP and devote it to defense, and yet we did not live like paupers, like parents and grandparents, or some of you great-grandparents, didn't live like peasants. In fact, during World War II, wages increased by 50%. You might say, but that's inflation. However, prices only increased in that period by 20%. So there was real wage growth. People were actually more prosperous while we were spending 40% of the GDP on defense with a lower marginal ability to do so. If we did that now, we would be spending $5.6 trillion on defense instead of subtracting war costs, about short of $500 billion. Many, many, many times that amount. If we spent money, this is exclusive of current war costs, if we spent at the peacetime levels, peacetime, not Vietnam, not Korea, not World War II, not the Gulf War, at the peacetime levels of the previous half century, the budget exclusive of current war costs would be $800 billion, which is approximately double what it is at present. So what we've been doing is we've been enjoying a peace dividend. When you enjoy a peace dividend, well then you very much endanger yourself of using option 10 to pay for the war, which is called losing. The question is, did the administration see this clearly and systematically? Well, and also, how did they choose among these options and why? I mean, I actually question whether they consciously chose among the options. I don't think they did. I mean, I knew most of them. I really don't think they did. They did choose four, which was to use the accumulated surplus monies and materiel. And they did do it, and that's why we're in such a lower position now. But that wasn't very deep. It didn't go very deep. It didn't last very far. They chose seven, which was spreading the costs among allies with contributions and cash returning to assumption responsibilities. And as you know, that was a coalition of the willing, but there was a willing, little teeny bit of willing, and it was mainly us. And by the way, I always wondered, coalition of the willing, what would the opposite of that be? A coalition of the unwilling? That was a rhetorical problem that they had. They were simply unable to carry that out successfully. They chose 8, 9, and possibly 10. In other words, drawing down military reserves without replacement, shorting procurement, reallocating forces so as to thin or abandon certain previously covered sectors and tasks that they chose. Fighting with insufficient resources and elongating the time that they chose, and unfortunately, possibly 10, which is called losing. Now, why did they do this? They did it, and this I know, I mean, we all know, but I know even specifically because I really talked to them a lot about it, is because they thought they were absolutely certain that the war would be much easier and far shorter. And the question derived from that is, why? Why did they think that when obviously it hasn't been so? And that's because, and I think this is a broad accusation, but I'm perfectly comfortable making it, they understood neither the area of operations, the Middle East, the nature of the enemy, the culture of Islam, or the culture of the Arab states in the Middle East, particularly of Iran, nor the nature of war itself, but they thought they did. So that's a very unfortunate thing. This goes into the rubric, of course, of how not to fight a war. What they were facing was a violent, autocratic, totalitarian government, which, when I say government, I mean in general, a culture of government, which was run by intrigue and assassination, never a democracy. In that entire area, it has never been a democracy. Turkey is sort of a democracy. Of course, Turkey is our NATO ally, it doesn't really count. And it's not really a democracy, it's kind of a pretend democracy as long as the military allows it to be what it is. It's not a genuine democracy. Israel is a democracy. Again, it's our ally, and it's just a little smidgen of something, and it doesn't really count for the region. But Iraq and Iran or Saudi Arabia or whatever have never had even anything vaguely like that since the beginning of time. The geography of that area is rather daunting. There are of Iraq, there are river obstacles, swamps, inundations, flooded areas. Inundations and flooded areas are so important in military geography. If you read Marlborough by Winston Churchill, you'll see that half of what Marlborough's life consisted of was dealing with inundations because he was fighting in the low countries. And Iraq has just as much water and swamp as the low countries. That's why Saddam Hussein drained it so he could kill the Shia in the south, because they were surviving despite the fact that they had no one to protect them and they had nothing really to fight with. They were surviving because they had the swamp. That was their main weapon, so he actually drained the swamps. It was a very large size. Iraq is a large country. It has not insignificant vegetative cover in orchards and stuff, so it's not like fighting in the desert when we fought in the Gulf War when there was no cover, because Iraq between the Tigris and the Euphrates is very much covered. There's shelter there. It's very thick in urban areas. 70% of the Iraqi population lives in cities. Baghdad is 4 million people. There are two other cities of more than a million. It's a country, of course, which is defined by its ethnicity and schisms. That's a fact of history. It's really three countries. And when Biden is criticized by McCain for having a crazy outlandish idea of dividing into three countries, it's not a crazy outlandish idea because it is in three countries. It is three countries. In the elections with the famous purple fingers, I don't think a single Shia voted for a Sunni or vice versa, or recorded. They voted according to their communities. They were simply reaffirming the division that exists. And it was not really a democratic election. It was three democratic elections. Because as a fact of history, that's how they govern. Sunni, Shia, Kurd, Arabs, tribes, Baathist elite, with further subdivisions and allegiances, which are sometimes so fiercely intertwined that there's no way to understand them. Even they don't understand them, much less us. And we, of course, don't even speak the language. And it's a very difficult language. I spent 3 years studying it, and I can't even order a glass of water in a restaurant. Relative to theater requirements, theater of operations in the Gulf is more than double the distance from what we've been focused on, which is NATO in Europe. And the port structure is much less. There are choke points, Gibraltar and Suez and the Bab al-Mandab, where Yemen is. Whereas to NATO, there were no choke points, and we control the sea. It's So it was very difficult to operation in that requirement. Restricted airspace, sovereign nations denied us overflight in some cases. We didn't have the access that we would have had in NATO Europe, and yet we were planning for this as if it were going to be easier than fighting in Europe. That's a force reducer. When you refer to force multipliers, that's a force reducer. And the transport force that we had when we embarked upon that war had already been reduced to approximately one-third of what it was in 1986. So with terribly insufficient resources, we embarked upon a very, very ambitious task. And then, of course, there's the lack of real allies. They only gave token contingents to us. So we didn't have the structure of the alliance. So all our war planning was completely turned on its head, topsy-turvy. And then desert operations and degradation, it really takes the life out of machinery because the sand gets in the gears and it clogs portals and ports and vision ports and everything like that. The desert is famously degrading of materiel. We might have asked the Israelis about that. They really know about that, and they know what happened to the Egyptians when the Russians sent their stuff to Egypt, and the Egyptians didn't know how to take care of it, and just, you know, half of their army was unusable because of that. Here comes another question, and this is not the trick question. The trick question was the first one. This is a legitimate question. What is the most important factor in war that the number one thing in deciding whether you're going to have victory or defeat? And I guarantee you that the Bush administration, much less the Democrats, never gave this a thought. The single most important factor in war.
Logistics?
Nope. Logistics is very important, but...
Understanding your enemy.
Understanding is very important, but it's not the single.
Will.
Fear of the troops.
Important, but no.
Will.
Will, no. You can say all day long, no one will get it. Well, maybe you will, but
geography
is extremely important. You know, I'm a big geography fan. War cannot be understood except by geography. You must be able to understand the map, otherwise you're nowhere. But no, it's not the same. Force
ratio.
What?
Force ratio.
Force ratio, no. No, oh no, because a little force can just whip a big force depending on the quality. So all those things are important. You can't necessarily put them in the hierarchical order because sometimes, depending on the situation, one is more important than the other. The single most important thing is, guess what? Something that we have absolute 100% control of at the beginning of the war, during the war, and at the end of the war. We have entire, complete, dictatorial control of it. And we didn't use it in this war. And that is determining war aims. It's the single most important. Let's say, for instance, I want to fight a war with Russia, and my aim is to weaken their capacity to develop their economy by blowing up some key dams. Okay, that's my war aim. I can probably do that. I mean, I can individually, but maybe even individually I can sabotage. If that's my aim, I have a limited aim, I win the war. But if my aim is to turn Russia into Disneyland and make everyone wear their underwear on their head, that's a different thing, okay? Or to plow it under and salt the ground and make every building into rubble. That's a much harder aim. So if you remember in World War II, Churchill and Roosevelt got together at the Argentia conference on battleships off Newfoundland, and they decided the war aims. The war aims were appropriate to the situation and appropriate to their capacities. Appropriate to what the United States and Britain and whatever other smaller allies could do, and appropriate to what needed to be done in order to suppress Germany forever. And that was, they said, we'll go all the way, unconditional surrender, and they did not change that for one second, from the beginning of the war all the way to the end of the war. There was no change in that. It was not malleable. It didn't change. And that's the absolute necessity. The rule of thumb is that war aims must be feasible, justifiable, and fixed. If you change them, you're a dead duck. Adjusting them to changing circumstances is really just another way of accommodating defeat. What were our war aims? They were extraordinarily elastic in this war. The first was a reaction to September 11th. We wanted to strike somebody. That's a legitimate war. I'm not saying that any of these are, that all of them are illegitimate, but just look at the history of them. Then we wanted to destroy the weapons of mass destruction. That was our next war aim. Then it was regime change, the next war aim. Then it was, and this is to quote the President of the United States, to end tyranny in the world. That was the war aim. Then it was to bring democracy to the Arab and Islamic worlds. Then it was to bring democracy to Iran. Then it was to fight terrorists in a forward position away from the United States. Then it was to defeat Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Then it was to restore order. Then it was to reduce violence. And now, today, it's to lessen our casualties so that we can withdraw. That was the history of our war aims. They changed according to whichever way the wind blew that day, whichever was convenient, because nobody had a conception of what exactly we should have done and how we should have done it. And those conceptions differ. I was a major proponent of, during the Gulf War, of going all the way to Baghdad. I wrote this in the newspapers, and I kind of was identified as the number one war hawk in going to Baghdad. And a lot of people were upset with that. I had a very interesting conversation with the first President Bush, in which we discussed this, and I said, this is why you should do it, because otherwise Saddam Hussein will just come back and he'll oppress the Shia, and you've got to finish it. We went to Berlin, we can go to this. And this, many people interpret this as an endorsement of what we've done since, but it wasn't, because President Bush said to me, the first one, he said, well, I didn't want to do that, he said, because this was after the Highway of Death stuff. He said, first of all, he said, that was not our mission. He said, that was not our aim. And that's commendable, because that was not the war aim to begin with, although I had recommended it, other people had recommended that. He said, and also, I didn't want to just kill people like shooting fish in a barrel. And he said, and namely, I did not want American soldiers to have to fight through Baghdad. And I said to him, Mr. President, that's what Syrians are for. You see? Mm-hmm. And we had Syrians with us. And that's what Saudis are for. And that's what our allies at the time, because he did establish a great coalition. So I was for going to Baghdad the first time, not the second time. I mean, the second time, yes, going and then only staying. Well, I'll get to that in a second. But the warnings that we had were sometimes good, sometimes feasible, sometimes not only impossible but unhinged, such as ending tyranny in the world. And the bottom line is the United States should not need to spend 5.5 years breaking its lance for an inconclusive result in Iraq. Now, what if we had to fight China or North Korea or Russia or any combination of them in between? We'd be absolutely out of the picture. They know it. And by the way, China is using this as its golden opportunity to push towards military parity with us. They love this. And so does Russia, as you can see if you read the news. Okay. So the next question is how it should be done. Talk about how it shouldn't be done. And I just want to give a little note on the surge. McCain says that the surge is working, and the surge is working in terms of one of the war aims, which is reducing violence. However, it does not change the basic situation. The way I see it, the Sunni decided that they saw that we were arming the Shia government in Iraq, supplying them with heavy weapons and training and soldiers and money and everything like that. And meanwhile, they were fighting us and the Shia. And they said, wait a minute, why are we doing that? Because we're fighting the United States and the Shia. Our battle is with the Shia. The Americans will go. So why don't we align with the Americans, get rid of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which is a real thorn in our side, and which they hated, even though they had a temporary alliance with it in the beginning. And let the Americans arm us and give us money, take the pressure off us, so that when the real battle comes, which is with the Shia, will have the arms and we won't be exhausted, et cetera. And that's what they did, and that was the awakening. This is a temporary condition, and it does not change the fact that this nation is divided into three parts, which will not unite into a democracy, and there will always be a problem. Now, I'm not concerned that it doesn't form a block against Iranian spillover into the rest of the Middle East, as I explained last night. I'm not concerned about that at all. But it still is a question. The question arises, what were we doing there for all this time? And I will present an alternative at the end of what I think we should have done that would have been successful. But if you're going to have a war in general, or this kind of war, you have a number of things you have to do. The first is the home front. Someone mentioned that. Very important. You have to mobilize national will. And to do that, you have to be able to make an argument. Unfortunately, George W. Bush does not like to make arguments by his own admission. He says he doesn't like to do that. And you can't do that if you're the President of the United States. You have to be, you have to yap. You have to talk. You have to defend your position. You have to expend the energy. You can't just say, because I said so, or because it's going to work, or whatever. You can't use your authority. You can't accept flatterers or sycophants. You must make the argument. And making an argument is a difficult thing. It strains you. It means you have to learn about the other side, and you have to listen to what they say. And if they embarrass you with their criticisms because you can't answer them, you have to adjust. Or at least you have to then find an argument which overcomes what appears to be an argument which impeaches yours. And this was not done. The President should have gone to Congress on September 12th. I expected that he would. He should have gone to Congress and said, I'm the President of the United States and the Commander-in-Chief. It is my sacred responsibility to defend this nation. Therefore, I ask you to give me what I need. And Congress would have given him anything he wanted. He had the whole nation mounted and ready, and instead he got off the horse. I have friends throughout the military. They told me that on September 12th, they would have stepped right into the Iliad at that point. They would have been the greatest soldiers that we have ever produced. They were ready to go. They were on the flight lines, they were in their tanks, and they wanted, above all, to fight. And Congress wanted to provide the wherewithal for them to fight. And the American people were angered and ready, within reason, to do what we had to do. But the President did not do that. The Democratic, it wasn't Democratic Congress, but Congress, including the Democrats, most Democrats, even most Democrats, wanted to spend more on the military at that point than the Bush administration allowed. They suppressed spending requests, and they said, no, we don't want to spend this, because, as I mentioned, they thought the war would be shorter and easier. They thought it would be a cakewalk. Also, you have to make sure if you're going to fight the war that you do so according to the dictates of the Constitution. I wrote columns saying we must declare war. People said, declare war on whom? They meant whom? Declare war on whom? There's nothing in the Constitution that says war has to be declared against a specific sovereign country. War can be declared against anyone who attacks the United States or facilitates those attacks, and you have a broad mandate. And Congress would have declared that war. And that would have obviated a great deal also had we gone into Iraq sooner than 18 months later after September 11th. In that 18 months, the day after September 11th, a coalition formed, a leftist coalition in New York and someplace in the center of the country, in Boston and San Francisco, and they started thinking about how they were going to protest the war that hadn't even begun. And they had, this administration gave them 18 months in which to mobilize throughout the world and in the United States. And that essentially paralyzed us. It also delinked the invasion of Iraq from September 11th. I won't go into the weapons of mass destruction, but I can say that I firmly believe that we really thought that Saddam Hussein had them. His own generals thought that his whole purpose was to fool them. It was not a trick or anything, although the way that they carried on, the way the administration carried on in not being frank with the American people made everyone think it was a trick. They essentially sabotaged their own credibility. You have to make a moral argument coherently and relentlessly, which again, he didn't. You have to adopt the right kind of war economics, which obviously was not done because we were spending far less, and they even turned down the opportunity to have more. And then there has to be some sort of focus and sacrifice. What we did was we fought a war, and the President said, take a woman of cover shopping, and go to restaurants and just live your normal lives. And we'll have the professional army do it, but in fact, the professional army was not equipped to do it because it wasn't big enough. So we called upon the reserves, who essentially were drafted. We said, we have no draft. Well, we do have a draft. We have stop-loss orders, and we have the reserves doing the job of the regular army, and that's a draft, because they didn't sign up for that, and they were actually compelled to do that. They did sign up, you know, in the contract it said they might have to be called, but traditionally, you know, since World War II, we haven't called the reserves in this way. And we did move the structure of the regular army so that it is almost completely dependent upon the reserves. Individual reserve soldiers who enlisted didn't know this because they didn't have a sophisticated view of what was happening. But in the past 15 years, the military has actually converted the reserves into a regular force. And all the, most of these people didn't know that. So what we ended up doing was, we shifting the costs of the war to the sons and daughters of certain Americans, and everyone else gets off scot-free. And that is bound to make a terrible political schism. And it's wrong. It's absolutely wrong. Now, I am not a, I'm not particularly fond of taxes or large government or anything of the nature of that nature, but it's I think, a fundamental principle, a fundamental conservative principle, and certainly a liberal principle, because liberal principle has no principles according to taxes. The liberal view of taxes is any tax is okay, so it passed with them. But among conservatives, the main reason you have taxes is a national emergency and defense. I am perfectly willing to do without if someone else is willing to lose their child in that war. And this understanding was not accepted by the administration, was not communicated to the American people. We were told, we don't have to sacrifice anything. But they do. They do. Their children have to die. No, your son, your daughter, your sister, your brother, whatever, is going to die. And that's just tough. That's the luck of the draw. But meanwhile, we get off scot-free. That was absolutely wrong, and that would ruin the war effort. And then there's the question of protection of national territory. We have not done this. Again, all these things can be expanded, but I'll just, do you have a little bit more time? You have three examples, sea, air, and border. Just to just touch upon these things. We have no sea protection on our sea borders. Let me give you an example of how it can be done. If you are taking a boat and you're going towards Israel, which I know about because that's where I serve, and I keep up on it. Radio queries started 200 miles out. You're 200 miles away from the shoreline of Israel, and you get radio queries. They increase in frequency and aggressiveness as you get closer. Increment. Every 10 miles you move in, you get more queries, and they're more aggressive, and they're more demanding. Then you notice, if you have the electronics, that you're being picked up on their radar, on their long-range radar, which is pinged all the time. So they know you're there and they're talking to you and they're interrogating you. This is well out to sea. You're passing over unseen passive surveillance nets. Now we have them all across the world's oceans. They're called SOSUS. They're underwater acoustic lines that monitor traffic, but they're not equipped to monitor civilian traffic approaching the United States. That's not what they're for. But Israel has them so that it actually is a coastal protection barrier. So they know, they see from the radar, they see from the air, they see from underneath the sea, exactly, they know the position of everything that's moving towards them, and they've plotted it out. At 50 miles out, suddenly you see unmanned UAVs, drones, over your ship or your boat, it could be a yacht, whatever, it could be a dinghy, and you're going to be photographed, and they're going to take electronic intelligence, and they're going to take infrared intelligence, maybe even smell your boat to see if it has explosives or do nuclear stuff. You're under full surveillance. At that point, then patrol aircraft then come over, manned aircraft, and Israeli, heavily armed Israeli naval patrol boats. And if they suspect that maybe you're a terrorist or mean them harm, they will send jet fighters also. This is what happens when you approach Israel. When you approach the coast of the United States, nothing. Nothing. And that's why the 1,100 tons of cocaine can be delivered to our shores without any problem. There's no. In World War II, we covered our coasts. There were patrolmen on every mile of beach. We had pillboxes, etc. It can easily be done. But we have absolutely nothing. In terms of sea, Singapore inspects every container for nuclear weapons. We only inspect about a third, spot check. Let me give you an example of airline traffic. When I was in the Israeli Army and Air Force, I had military identification. I spoke fluent, although incorrect, military Hebrew. And I was in my uniform. I was part of the culture, et cetera. And I knew, for instance, the soldiers who inspected us were fellow soldiers, and I knew how to speak to them in their own idiom. My wife at the time was a blonde, blue-eyed American who neither of us fit the profile of a terrorist. And I had all this identification. We were both citizens and Americans. And yet, they took apart everything we had. They interrogated me for half an hour, asking me all kinds of questions. They examined my documents carefully. They pried off the heels of my shoes before I got on that plane. And that's why since 1968, when Al Al was the first airline to suffer air piracy and destruction, since 1968, it hasn't lost a single plane. Because they take the information. Now, we could say they only have, 60 planes. In America, there are tens of thousands, 10,000 airliners. We can't do that, but yes, we can. We can do it. We can do any of those things. Just as an analogy, as an example for that, think about land borders. Our land borders are porous, and there's this big debate about whether we should build a fence and this, that, everything. Of course, the length of a border, just like the length of a seacoast, depends upon the unit of measurement. It's like Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. But because if you measure by the mile, then you're going to miss all this winding and stuff. If you measure by the micron, it becomes much, much, many orders of magnitude longer. But roughly, we have 5,000 miles of land border. In that, and we say we can't protect it, and it's unprotected. Anyone can walk over it. It's very easy. If we had 100 UAVs, that would be 50 miles per UAV per sector. And if we had 25,000 border patrolmen, that would be 5 per mile. That, along with networked surveillance stuff, both seismic, optical, infrared, et cetera, and various passive detectors, cameras, random patrols, could completely seal the borders. That's only 25,000 border patrolmen, which would be an addition of maybe, I don't know how many there are, just maybe 5 or 10,000. We can afford to do that. We can afford to protect the country from the kind of terrorist strike which we will in the future receive. We haven't done it. That's another way to fight a war. And finally, let me close with what I think and what I recommended at the time that we should do. I can't present it fully because it was a very complicated plan, but roughly in sum, what I said was that we should have invaded Iraq. The reason we should have invaded Iraq is because Iraq was the center of gravity for the Islamic world. The attack against us came from the entire Islamic world. If you look at the polls, if you look at the celebrations that happened after September 11th, it was the whole world, variously. Some countries more, some countries less, some segments of the population more, some less. But the support came from Saudi Arabia, it came from Egypt, it came from Morocco, the personnel, the funds, even possibly embassy participation, and popular support from the entire Arab world. Now, we can't go to war against the entire Arab world because it's too big and it wouldn't do anything anyway. So how do you do that? What you do is you make your war aim psychological, which is to show that you can strike their strongest point, their center of gravity, and defeat it quickly and decisively. And then you have to withdraw. And you won't end everything. But what it will do is teach a lesson to the regimes, which in those countries are police states. They know their culture. They know their people. They have, if not absolute control, they have very, very tight control. And you tell them, because they live for power, you say, if you don't do our bidding in this regard, which is to eliminate the terrorists among you, which you can do because you are police states and you do know the language and culture and you know who they are. If you don't do this, we will eliminate you. So as a demonstration of that, you attack the strongest point, which was Iraq, which is also geographically the center of gravity. And what I recommended was that we go, that we take down the Saddam Hussein regime, which we should have done in 3 days, by the way. And I think I may have mentioned this before. Tell me if I did. You heard a lot about how we were supposed to. Did I say this before? We were told that it was the fastest advance in the history of warfare, et cetera, et cetera. 3 weeks from Kuwait to Baghdad. I did say it, didn't I? Yeah. Okay. So I want to repeat it. It wasn't fast. We could have done it in 3 days. They I knew that Turkey would not allow us to move it from. I told this to the people who were in the highest positions. And they said, oh no, the Turkish generals have promised us that. I said, no. Well, this time the Turkish generals can't make that promise because France has told Turkey that it's not going to get into the EU, it's not going to get into the EU anyway, if you do this. And I said, well, how do you know that? And I'm the Secretary of Defense. How do you know that? And I said, I don't know it. I think that it's true because it's almost got to be true. And that's what you've got to count. And it was really true. But I didn't know it. I just figured it out. Anyway, we should have gone to Baghdad, taken down the Saddam Hussein regime. And immediately, there would have been more candidates to replace him as strongmen in alliance with us than there have been in the last 20 American presidential elections. They would have arisen in such great numbers that you would have had to have crowd control. Generals, no, I'll do it. You pick one and you lay down the conditions for him. You say, we will be back and we will kill you unless you do the following. Weapons of mass destruction, which we thought were there, eliminate all of them. Get out all the terrorists among you, et cetera, et cetera. Tell them what to do, and they would have done it. Then I think we should have wheeled the army, because our armies know how to fight, and they know how to cross large territories. That's what we're good at, and they like doing it when they're tasked with doing it. We should have wheeled west and done the same thing in Baghdad. Because Damascus, because Damascus is a real problem. And it would have taken a couple weeks to do it, and you'd lay down the same terms in Damascus. And then we should have wheeled back south, southeast, and settled in this area, I don't have a map, north of Riyadh, between on the Iraqi and Saudi Arabian border, where the Saudis have built military infrastructure to counter, and we have largely paid for it, to counter the threat from Iraq when it was extant. It's a very modern military infrastructure with air bases and land bases, pipelines buried under the ground, electricity. It backs off to the sea, which we control. We would have been hermetically sealed there. We would have no casualties from any insurgency. We would have been within 3 days' march of Riyadh, Baghdad, and Damascus, where regimes would have risen to do our bidding. And our soldiers could have trained. We could have taken home a great number of them, and the ones there could have been available for use if some emergency had happened someplace else. The forces wouldn't have been degraded, et cetera. We wouldn't have casualties. If we had done this, not 18 months after September 11th, but within a few months, and if we had done it that way, this war would have been over in 2002, and we would have won decisively. Now, maybe I'm wrong. I know that. But in my view, I think that would have worked. So that is roughly my take in sum, believe me, I left out a lot of details on how to fight a war and how not to. Thank you. Something that everyone talks about, which is the structure of the political system, which encourages people who are good at getting to positions, but they don't know anything once they get to the position about how to exercise the power that they do know how to obtain. And I've experienced this a lot in my limited contact with politicians, but I find that most of them have extraordinary genius in regard to impressing people, fooling them. You know, it's amazing how they can make you think that you are the center of the world while they're talking to you, and they're going to do everything you say, They never, they have, they really know how to do that. And then they don't do anything. And they're really not listening to you. They're just sort of manipulating you and using you. They use people like crazy. They're good at that. It is a genius. But they, what they often don't have is a genius for policy or a moral standing or courage or any kind of decent education which would enable them to see through these very complicated mists and clouds into what to do. And I think part of that is a lack of individual courage. Part of it is that it really is systemic, among other things. You have to have enormous amounts of money in order to get into any political position in the United States, any elected position. And that sort of runs counter to what you would be, you know, if you have someone who's been studying and thinking truthfully and honestly about these things and who knows about them, who has the experience in actually doing them, the person's usually not a good fundraiser. And he's usually not a good liar either. So doesn't have access to power. And then in terms of the point of office, the people whom presidents take around them, of course, there are great people like that who are willing to flatter, you know, and willing to base themselves in order to get into those positions for the sake of the country. It has been done. But on the other hand, these days, for instance, I'm a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. And I never ever go there because it's very upsetting, really. Because what you have is they have a sort of an Italianate palace on Park Avenue, and it's very elegant. Everyone is beautifully dressed because the people who are members of the Council on Foreign Relations are lawyers from big firms and heads of corporations and professional diplomats who are in between assignments, former secretaries of state, et cetera, et cetera. So it's very elegant, and it's an elite bastion. And of course, many conservatives think of it like the Trilateral Commission as a sort of an evil plotting place where it's very well coordinated. But it isn't, because it's just a bunch of people who are, each one is there to polish his own apple. And you go to a meeting in a place like that, and nobody is really listening to anyone else. Everyone is just waiting for his chance to raise his hand and say, and give beautifully spoken, impressive little nugget of something so that eventually he can be appointed to some position. It's all lawyers who want to be Secretary of State. And there really is very little thought given to the interests of the country. You would not find George Marshall there. So I don't even go there anymore. And these are the kind of people who get appointed to things these days. They're people who have resumes, and the resumes don't necessarily mean anything. Also, there's a degradation of the educational system in general, a degradation of values. If you're a nation that mocks the idea, even the idea of honor and courage, then how can you expect to have honorable and courageous leaders?
Yeah, I'm going to bring up the name Colin Powell. Mm-hmm. Not a politician. In regard to both the First Gulf War and the Second. There's a graduate of this philosophic institute, Mac Owens, who was charged that he misled Bush I about the actual battlefield conditions, and Bush I stopped at 100 hours. You held the view, and you mentioned that you know, we should go all the way back then. Kissinger has a book in which he says, why were these the only choices to stop at 100 hours? There's the Republican Guard and what they will do when you rouse up the Shia, a dishonorable thing to do, since you didn't protect them after you roused them up, which you want. Then the second regard, the current president was weak on foreign policy. In his campaign, he let out signals, my Secretary of State will be Colin Powell. Seth Benedetti said about that, you can't fire him, and you should never have a Secretary of State that you can't fire. So, is what's inevitable once you made that choice to get elected, right, that you would have somebody who's known for the doctrine of exit strategy. I presume every general in the world wants to fight an opposing general who's thinking about his exit strategy, other than victory. And therefore, you're going to spend 18 months convincing the French, not really. You're going to wait to do this, and you're going to emphasize these blurred ideas about what the purpose of the war is. You know so much more about this. Tell me your view of these matters, of this particular matter.
Well, I'll tell you one thing about Colin Powell. Colin Powell, of course, is the locus of the Powell Doctrine, which is, he personifies it more than anyone else, which he learned from Vietnam. And the lesson that we learned from Vietnam is that good lessons. If you're going to go to war, you go all the way. And this he did. For instance, the difference between the first Gulf War and the second Gulf War is in the first one, there were 500,000 troops and enormous amounts of stuff. I can't tell you who, but someone in the very top floor of the Pentagon said to me during this war, when I was arguing for that kind of approach, he said, why should we do that when the last time we only used 10% of what we had? So this time we only need 10% and we have 20 or 25% of it, so we're more than, and so what I said was you can't ever have a war which is not based on surplus. You must have surplus. You can't chance it. It's not business. Just-in-time inventory doesn't work. In business, you have Rumsfeld is a businessman. The ethos is you do the most you can with the least, and the difference is your profit. In war, the profit doesn't come from that because what you have to do is you have to devote much more than you need because of the exigencies of war, because you don't know how it's going to turn out. So this business school philosophy, which also Rumsfeld shared with the president, is what got us in trouble, and Powell was opposed to that from the get-go. He believed that if you're going to fight, you go all the way, you go with tremendous force, and you go with a surplus. He also believed that if you're going to do it, you have to enlist a coalition and allies. Now that was not possible because of the European view. Now was that so because of the Europeans, or did it have something to do also with us? At the time, what I thought was, if the president had gone right after September 11th to England, France, Italy, Germany, Spain, even some of the Arab countries, and if he had given speeches, in my Walter Mitty fantasy, I every day I run or row, and it takes a couple of hours. I'm out for a couple of hours, and so I'm having lots of manic Walter Mitty fantasies. And I gave speeches in French and Italian and other Spanish and German, what the president would say. If I had been president, which will obviously never happen, I would have gone to, I would have spoken to the French in French. Now, I got help from somebody to make sure that it was grammatically correct, otherwise, believe me, it wouldn't have been, and inspire them. And he could have done it in English at least, maybe. Well, actually, he couldn't have done it in English. To the English. But you do it in the language of the country, and you appeal to them. And you say, and you appeal to the history, and you say, look, we have come many other times, and now we're asking for your help, which is also help for you, because this is a common enemy, and we will be reasonable, and we won't overstretch, etc., but come with us to fight. Nobody did that. Instead, they enjoyed sort of having a pissing contest with the Europeans. Colin Powell was against that. So I really have a different view of him in that respect. And during the first Gulf War, in terms of, now I don't know if he misrepresented to Bush about the situation. I don't think so, because I know from speaking to Bob Gates exactly what they knew and when. Believe me, the president was not kept out of any loop. He knew everything that was happening. This was a very tight. However, their intelligence estimates in terms of things like casualties and how the war would go, et cetera, were not particularly good. And there were there was a private estimate that was given that the DCI, who was then Bob Gates, said was better than any government estimate. And this was made by one person who had no access to any classified documents and no staff and not even a secretary. So.
I should add that Colin Powell is to be credited. When Jesse Jackson was saying he'd go negotiate between us and the Taliban, Colin Powell said, I hope he stays. And it said that with Philip Pan, at one point he said, shall we take away all the graves that our soldiers have left on your soil? So.
Yeah, oh yes, yeah. That's for sure. I mean, we always like, everyone likes to make villains, and what you find, for instance, what I found when I go on book tours, and there are a lot of people who really, really hate me. I mean, they've come to hate me because it's sort of like the internet, you know, much hatred and violence on the internet. So you make a villain, and it's fun to hate somebody. When I go on a book tour, I might encounter in a literary type book tour. A lot of those people are in the audience, and I see them coming in, and they look at me, and they're really angry, and I think it could kill you. In fact, I have been attacked, a woman with a knife in Marin County. In Seattle, a woman attacked me with a waste paper basket. But she was walking on stage behind me back and forth, and then she picked up a waste paper basket and smashed her in my head. The woman with the knife ran up the aisle with the knife. There was a plainclothes cop in the audience because they knew about this woman, and he grabbed her and disarmed her, which I think was unfortunate because I wanted to do it. But what I found is that when you actually face an audience that hates you, then they discover that maybe you're not so bad. And I that actually happened to me. I was, when I was younger and more impressionable, there were people who in the 60s that everyone liked to hate, and they would then come and speak, and you thought that, well, they're actually human beings. They're not so. I'll tell you one more thing, because I know we probably have run out of time. But I mentioned, I think, at some time, it's very confusing to me, it's all like a big soup now. At some point when I was talking, and I've been talking for 2 days, that my mother was an actress, and she was, during the Depression, her family, which had 8 children, was literally starving, so she was kind of sold by her parents to a Shakespeare company run by an Englishman named Reginald Good. And she never got beyond the 8th grade, and then she became an actress in both on Broadway and Hollywood. And there, she kind of was taken up by that tide, and she joined the Communist Party. So she was a communist. And those people, believe me, did not like Richard Nixon. And I was brought up, and I was, after all, from infancy, to think that Richard Nixon was the devil incarnate. Now, I had a friend whose name was Fred Alford, and actually went to University of Texas at Austin, got his PhD, and I think he teaches there, I don't even know. But we were in high school, and he was my friend. He was a junior Davis Cup tennis champion. In fact, he looked like a grasshopper, but he was a great tennis player. And his father was named Starley Fletcher Milner Alford III, a Texan from the beginning. His first job was to inspect bathrooms of Texaco stations in the Depression. And he'd go in a car and inspect all these bathrooms. If the bathroom was dirty, he'd make the owner clean it, and he carried cleaning supplies in the trunk of his car and stuff. He started that way, but he rose to become the president of Caltex, which is the Texaco foreign arm. So they based him in New York. That was Fred's father. And one day I was at Fred's house after school, and Fred said, do you want to stay for dinner? And I said, okay. My house was 5 miles north of the school, his house was 5 miles south. So I called my parents and said, could you pick me up? And they said, okay, you can stay for dinner. So we were up in Fred's room, and his mother called and said, it's dinner time. So we went down to dinner, and at the dinner table in their dining room, and they lived rather simply. By the way, so did Rupert Murdoch, not so long ago, because we almost bought his house, and believe me, if we could buy the house, it's not that expensive. They lived, there's a small dining room, nothing grandiose. And there was Fred and me, and Fred's father and Fred's mother and Pat and Richard Nixon. So I find myself sitting next to Richard Nixon, whom I had been told, was the devil incarnate since infancy. And I didn't know what to do, so I just played it by ear. And during the whole dinner, I found that first of all, he was very interested in Fred and me and what we were studying. You know, what do you think of the American political scene? And what was your impression of American political democracy? And we talked to him, and he was genuinely interested in us, and he was genuinely humble. And as a person, I really, really liked him. And that happened. So watch out. Watch for villainization. By the way, because of that, I entirely misjudged him in Watergate, and to the very bitter end, I did not believe that he had ordered the break-in, which, in fact, the National Archives proves that he did, and other break-ins just like them. But I supported him to the end because of a mistaken personal affection for him. And on the other hand, he was in many ways a good president. So, but as far as Colin Powell goes, don't write him off entirely. And he himself didn't run for president, supposedly because his wife is mentally ill and she would not have been able to take the strain. And from what I know of presidential campaigns, that's absolutely true, because it's just beyond belief. Is that it, or is it a guy who raised his hand in the back?
Another question, please, yes.
Yeah, way back,
Yeah, I want to follow up on your analysis of the way in which the vote was conducted.
Could you stand up, because I can't.
And the justification that was given. I think I agree with you that the question of what the end was, was never really talked about. The argument was really what justification. So my question is, for people, many people I know who supported the war at the outset, came to be wary about it afterwards, because in part they were really convinced by your analysis that there was no sense of what the end was. There was no calculation about it. And I guess my question is, is there any reason to expect that in another war there will be such thoughtful analysis about how to conduct the war to achieve the end? And that is, when we're now thinking about the justification for going to war,
right,
don't we have to think about, is this administration capable of achieving a proper end?
Yeah, I as to whether that will, for the next war, whenever that is, and against whom, I don't know. But as to that question, I don't know. I mean, I have no idea, but I can tell you one thing that the question suggests, and that is, when I find myself very often in a position which is just nowhere, because unfortunately the country polarized between one side, which said that there was no reason for the war and we're evil, and it's because of Bush and Cheney want the oil companies to have money and Halliburton to have money, and we invaded it for oil, which of course is nonsense. We could have invaded Venezuela. It would have been much closer and cheaper and better oil, better food, and better climate. And then the other side, which said essentially that if you criticize the conduct of the war, then it's because you're against it to begin with. Well, I was attacked for saying that we were really slow to go in, that we should have gone in massively, et cetera, et cetera. And then I'm also attacked for criticizing the conduct of the war. So in the middle, of course, since it's the position that I hold to, I think it's best, is the position that, yes, sometimes it's necessary to fight a war, and in this case it was, but it has to be done intelligently, and the way it was done was very bad, and therefore, if you criticize that, it's not because you are. In fact, I won't go into it in particulars, but I've been called unpatriotic and a leftist and a communist, which really mystifies me. Because the people on the left, so that's the left, my left, it's your left. People on the left, wherever it is, really think that I'm a right-wing Warhawk, crazy fascist pig. One more question that I got.
Being the proud daughter of a Stealth Fighter Pilot and Gulf War One. As I understand it, Gulf War One was fought like mainly or largely by air power. Can you just say something, maybe it's too militarily technical a question, but like about the prudent allotment of work between various branches of the military in a place like the Middle East?
Yeah, I can. I was in the Israeli Air Force, and I have a bias for, although I was in the ground combat division of it, but nonetheless, you know, you get the institutional bias of the service that you're in. And there are two things to say about that. The first is that unfortunately now, beginning with Rumsfeld and also particularly with Gates, there is this feeling that we have to turn the armed forces into a gendarmerie only to fight low-level, low-scale terrorism. And we're only talking about fighting a couple of score thousand people, maybe 100,000 people throughout the whole world. And what they're doing is reconfiguring the armed forces at great risk, because eventually we may have to, at least we do have to deter China and Russia, if not fight them. And we might eventually have to fight them, or North Korea or something. In which case we will need heavy formations and things like Crusader and the artillery, and particularly the Air Force. And what's being done now is the Air Force is being decimated. For instance, the F-22 is the world's best air dominance fighter. It's called the Raptor, and it's miles and miles ahead of any plane in the world, although the Russians and the Chinese are aiming towards building an equivalent plane, and they will. The original buy, I think, was 683 F-22s, because all the F-16s and F-15s are becoming aged and they're leaving the force. We were going to buy 683 F-22s, although the F-22 is much more capable than the F-16 or the F-15 or the F-18. Nonetheless, you know, Norman Augustine, who was a defense contractor and a very brilliant man who wrote about this, posited that eventually we'll be building only one airplane, which would be so expensive and so capable that we'll only have one airplane. No matter how capable an airplane is, if it's shot down, you've lost it. If it's 20 times more capable than your former airplanes, one is shot down, you've lost the equivalent of 20 airplanes. And you can't have one airplane in two places at once. And when one airplane is in the shop, if it replaces 20, then you've got the equivalent of 20 in the shop. So that there is something to be said about numbers and not concentrating. You need really the best stuff, but you still need a lot of it. And it went from 683 F-22s to 380, and now it's settled down to 183, which would leave us with approximately 165, because of the maintenance requirements, at any one time to cover the entire world. And this now the Secretary of the Air Force Wynn, and the head of the Air Force, the chief of staff of the Air Force, were essentially in a war with the civilian arm of the Pentagon, and saying you can't cut the Air Force like this because we won't be prepared for future wars and we won't be able to deter them and we won't be able to discourage China from its military buildup, and we're essentially putting ourselves in a pre-World War II position. And they were fired on the pretext of the nuclear stuff that went on, the nuclear mismanagement. It was just a pretext. They are like the Billy Mitchells of today. They're fighting there. But on the other hand, air power in the Middle East, you know, we certainly need air power. We need it for transport. What people don't know is that a large reason that our casualties have been reduced is because instead of going on land to all these remote fire bases that we have and patrol bases, we now take it by air. We don't go on the ground anymore, which is in a way kind of a retreat, and it's not a sign of victory, but at least it reduces our casualties. That's necessary. It's necessary to dominate the air in any situation. But in both Afghanistan and Iraq, the number of air sorties and bomb releases has gone up almost exponentially in the period of the surge and even beginning before the surge. And unfortunately, despite the fact that we have very precise weapons, and particularly one called the small diameter bomb, which was designed for this war and to take out a very, very tiny little space so as to eliminate what is euphemistically called collateral damage. Despite that, civilian casualties have gone up tremendously. And in Afghanistan, this is, it's of course, the worst is that it's killing the children and civilians, but it's also very bad for any war effort because it will turn this, the population against us and it's counterproductive. So you, in a guerrilla war, you cannot rely on airstrike. You simply cannot do that in cities and villages because you will kill too many civilians. But you do need air power as a support, in a supportive role, especially for surveillance, reconnaissance, watching the routes and everything. Let me just give you one more example. I don't need to overrun the time. But I have a friend who manufactures the Predator and now the follow-on to the Predator, which is called the Reaper, which is an unmanned vehicle which can carry 18 Hellfire missiles and bombs. And it's very lethal. It's like a fighter. But the best thing that these things can do is they can go up and loiter unseen and unheard and cover a 50-mile square of territory and know everything that goes on there. If you divide Iraq into 50-mile squares, you do all the math and everything, what it comes down to is we could have had 24-hour coverage with night vision, infrared, and side aperture radar, which would take us right close.